I already have to laugh. I had a shower thought this morning. Mm-hmm. You know, like, you're under the shower and suddenly you just get an idea and you're like, wow, it just makes sense.
With the whole, mm-hmm.
Everything makes sense. I figured when I feel emotionally stressed, physically stressed, or just like overly dirty in any certain type of way, if I use black soap, I will feel like a newborn baby. Mm-hmm. Mentally, spiritually, emotionally, I'll feel cleansed. Mm-hmm. And I stood in the shower and I was like, yeah, this kind of cleansing is what I need for today's episode.
Transitions are transitioning. Hey! What are we talking about today?
We're talking about the demonization of African traditional beliefs. Mm-hmm. And we already had a little clip on our socials that is currently kind of trending.
Kind of trending, yeah.
Kind of trending. But maybe before we dive into that, let's talk about something else. Just very briefly.
Make me lose my breath. Make me water.
We're gonna talk about this. We have to talk about it. What happens?
So I went on Twitter, and you know Twitter is a war zone. Like, people are committed to misunderstand you. So someone said that Tyler should consider herself black because she is not in America. In America, there are black rules, and this is how she's perceived in America.
In America, there are black rules? Wild.
Black rules in...
Yeah,
you
I
know,
get.
Quotation marks.
It's like, it's wild.
But
yeah,
it's the, wild. The interesting part is Tyler considers herself colored, and colored is a race in South Africa, an ethnic category. On the census, you can take white, black, colored, Asian, Indian, etc. And on top of...
I didn't know that until 2 or 3 weeks ago. Mm. I'll give you a little story. I wasn't aware of that, mm-hmm. because, I don't know, I never really dived into these categories like that.
Okay.
So a couple of weeks ago, I was at dinner with a journalist friend of ours, Fatima, shout out to her, mm-hmm. and with the MIK boys and with Jessica Mashaba, South African content creator and dancer.
This woman, sabi people.
And she was like...
Continue. Carry on.
I mean, give me a break. So we're at dinner and she said like, she was telling us a story and she just randomly asked and she was like, okay, hold on. What do you guys consider yourselves here? Because we say colored in South Africa. And all of us looked at her and was like, wow. Okay, tell us more about it. And that is how I found out about the term colored, and even had a discussion with some people and was like, it's so interesting to see how the meaning changes depending on the country you're in, mm-hmm. and how people expect you to then change your identity based on what they believe is true.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think what played a role into that is American exceptionalism. There was also valid criticism that said that the term colored is a slur in the United States. So they're not comfortable calling a person that they perceive as black as colored. But then I was asking myself, do you remember when BTS had that one song, fake love, fake love, fake love? And they used the word nigger. It's not the N word. It means I in Korean. And they changed it.
Yeah.
Out of cultural sensibility. But that is, in a way, I thought about that because I wanted to see from that perspective. But then I thought about it again. That is a word. So you can kind of change it's a language. The other thing is a culture.
It's not even only a culture, it's part of an identity. Exactly. You know, she identifies herself as exactly. colored, and so she shouldn't, you know, mm-hmm. from the outside, the diaspora and Black Americans or whatever, West Africans exactly. or whatever, should not be the ones
because it's an
taking that.
Because it is also an identity marker. So colored is basically people of Khoisan, Indian, some African ethnic groups mesh together to create this umbrella term of colored, and they intermix over generations. So it is not, it's not a thing where you could say from an American perspective, oh, you're this American, you that American. Sometimes you cannot trace it because both her parents are also colored. So the mixing is also there. So it's a completely different understanding. And I think we need to understand that there is not black, there is blackness. So there are different, you know, there's a plethora of black identities.
And let me put it in your words. We are not a monolith.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I think that's really the yeah. discussion about it. And what I found interesting is that we asked some people who identify as colored, who are colored in South Africa, why am I rolling my ass like that? And they explained to us what it means and the differences, and also how colored communities are different, because also colored is not a monolith, as you said. So I will, yeah. we will so put it there.
Let's listen to this here. I think it's very important to get their perspectives because we are not in a position to talk about it. We can talk about it from a journalistic point of view or from a research point of view in a way, but it would be arrogant to exclude their individual experiences.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
thanks to them for reaching out and trusting us with your experiences.
If you would then break it down and tell some random person on the street what is, from your perspective, colored, even though it's so difficult, what would you answer?
So in South Africa, we have a pretty strict distinction between black people and colored people, which basically boils down to the fact that colonizers came, you know, and they did what colonizers do, which is divide and conquer, specifically on the basis of the 1948 Race Classification Act. So they divided South African population into white, colored, black, Indian, and Chinese people. And under white supremacy, this obviously meant that your proximity to whiteness meant more access to privileges. So the lighter your skin was, etc., the better, like, set of circumstances you had, and more privileges were awarded to you. So while colored and black are racial or racially constructed categories, it's also important to keep in mind that they are political and social categories too. So me myself, for example, I'm South African colored, and even though in the West, for example, in Germany, where I am at the moment, I am perceived as light-skinned black, I would not identify as black in the context of South Africa, simply because me, myself, my parents, my family, my race, just the oppression that we experience in South Africa and also during apartheid is not at the same level as so-called black people experience.
Well, there is colored in a political sense, and to be colored, which is a cultural sense. One is colored by growing up in a colored area. Colored is not exactly mixed race, and colored is its own culture. It's kind of like a mixture of many different cultures together that adds vibrancy and color to everything, if you're formulating it positively.
Yes.
If you're looking at it from a negative sense, it's a place where it's very difficult to understand the identity and also perceive the identity for yourself, because in colored areas it's rough, hey. It's totally rough, but also like it's funny. It's like it's a place that you don't want to be stuck in at night. Yeah, there's always a fight that breaks up. At the same time, it's like the best party you've been to this year. So it's like it, to be colored is a vibe. Like I said, my surname is Skulls, but if I would have grown up, for example, in Soweto and spoken an ethnic language, I wouldn't exactly be colored. Because I grew up in Bosmont, mm-hmm. which is like on the periphery, also right next to Soweto practically, or Rivoli, or Newclay, or Westbury. I mean, I lived in Newclay and Westbury, and also in Rivoli. That's like colored areas. Also, colored is in different pockets. So you got the Cape Coloreds, which is also like Cape Malays, okay. and very Muslim, and very like, you got Yusufs and whatever. I also got like Zunaid, which is a very good friend of mine. But if you look at him, you think like he's a Pakistani guy, but really he isn't. He is colored.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And if I think about all the surnames in my family and also my class, we got Petersons, we got Ben, we got Dawi, we got Van Veek, we got Slummert. I'm a Skults. My mother's in Eastwood. My elder sister, she was very light-skinned, had dark red hair, freckles. My other brother and sister, they're shorter than I am. They much darker in skin than I am. And then I am kind of like in the middle. That looks like a mixed race guy, caramelish in color.
That was the confusing part for me, because looking at you, as I said earlier, I would read you like as a mixed race person,
mm-hmm.
let's say like who has like Southeast Asian or with the epicentric eye holds. So this is mm-hmm. how I would perceive you. But at the same time, then people from South Africa over the internet, they push back and say, no, we're not black. I have two color parents. Mm-hmm. And as in like in Tyler's case. So I wanted to ask you, what are like characteristics where you know, okay, that person is colored? It can come from language or mm-hmm. Even cultural identity markers.
I think it's very difficult to explain like the color palette, that the color skin palette you would find within coloreds, because you get everything from white passing to Latina looking to Brazilian to very dark skinned to whatever skin color. For us, black means ethnic black. If you think about black people, you think about tribes and traditions. We don't belong to a tribe. And for me and my family, we all have European names as coloreds. Mostly have European names. We do not have, like, let's say this ethnic African names. For example, one of the famous ones is Tshabalala. We don't have a Tshabalala, because Tshabalala means that within the name, they know exactly the river that they come from. That's the tribe that comes from that area, and he belongs to that family. Same with a Mandela. A Mandela is a person from that specific part that comes from that tribe in that area, divided by this family and that family. And this is what colored people in South Africa really don't have, is this, how can I say, rituals and customs within our society. And that's a result of, let's call it, post-colonialism mm-hmm. and apartheid. We're talking about 50, 60 years ago. In some ways, I'm angry that I do not speak an ethnic language, or Zulu, Pedi, Xhosa, Venda, whichever one I would take, because it comes with a totally different understanding of how, where you come from, where your ancestors come from. If we look at colonialism, I've got a very colonialist name, Skulls, Schultz in German, And then if you look at apartheid, I'm segregated. So I'm cut off again. And I don't have either of them. Even though me as a colored, I can navigate the world. I fit into so many different cultures all over the world. I brought up the example of a friend of mine, Wesley, that lived in Berlin for a long while. They thought he was Turkish. When I'm here, people think I'm everything. I could be French. I could be Portuguese. I am African, but they don't know where in Africa. So then I say I'm South African. Then like South Africa. I'm like, no, from South Africa. And if you look at this rainbow nation of South Africa and people living in Europe, it's very difficult for people to get in their minds that there's white South Africans, meaning white, perceived as white people that grew up in South Africa and call themselves South African, is kind of a similar discrepancy in people's perception of the world, especially in Europe. Or mm-hmm. I'm sure in America it's the same thing. Like if a white person comes in and they say, I come from Africa, it's a very difficult thing to explain. For me, I lean more. My feet is planted exactly in the colored area. My heart says I've got an ethnic soul. It feels like I'm really in tune to the drum. I'm a piano, obviously, is based on the drum. And then if I think like my education and how I can present myself, I fit also into this white, predominantly white structures that I have to be in place in at the moment. So colors also have this very fine line struck that connects the two somehow, where it's articulate, could be aggressive as well as being supple, and really having emotionally intelligent way of navigating the world that is, I would say, unique to the colored experience.
You haven't lived that experience even. Every single time you define it, and I think people coming from the outside, they want something like, if it's an apple, it is not a banana.
Mm-hmm.
But in your explanations, it's then, oh, I get now what an apple is. And then you tell me, on some occasions, the banana can also be apple. Like, if the college speaks that language or is from that area, or is phenotypically could go or pass as a colored, for like Teva Anua, to have a famous example.
Mm-hmm.
But culturally, he's like, as you said, black or mixed. Yeah. He's mixed race,
yeah,
because he speaks in African indigenous language, and is in that way. He's not having a white wedding. He could also have like.
He could also have a white wedding. He's also got. He also comes from the big European family. And that's what apartheid did, you know. In colonialism, it cut off the tribal sense, yeah. So that's why I got this very German surname. And then apartheid came and severed us off the big family, meaning the European sense, because of the big families and so on. And then we're here in this chasm, so to speak, of ourselves. That's why we have everything from an Asian-looking white passing person or Latina looking.
What makes colored identities and culture so unique is that we are the most diverse race in the world, right? So we're just too diverse to be categorized in a small little box that colonizers can tick off in their classifications. Like we've got Khoisan blood, which is like the first group of people known to humankind, right? We have Malaysian, European, Indonesian, Chinese, Indian, all just like mixed in like the most different variations. So just speaking from my own experience, what I find unique about colored identity is the fact that, for example, everyone in my family is perceived as a completely different race outside of South Africa, while in South Africa, we are all belong to the same race. So outside of South Africa, I'm perceived as light-skinned black. My mom is perceived as Indian. My dad is perceived as Chinese with like natural Afro hair. Some would maybe call it Blasian, black and Asian. My sisters are perceived as Indonesian. So yeah, we're just kind of like out here expanding our colored identity, or what colored identity means for us, I guess. And I think what makes colored identity so unique, for instance, in my family, half of the family celebrates Eid and Ramadan. The other half celebrates Christmas. We eat samosas and masala chicken curry, right? We say, yes, sir. Yes, ma'am, in English. Our parents shouted us in Afrikaans. We say kanala and terima kasih in Malay. We say salam alaikum in Arabic.
Is that also the reason why Tyler now, with her success and being her on world stage, just means so lot for a lot of South Africans, to be more specifically colored people?
I think it's fantastic. I think it's like, just let us move away from the colored term as a derogatory term. Mm-hmm. Let's look at it from what it is now, which is more an ethnicity to what it's grown into and somehow formed into an identity that it's made for itself. Thinking also that we are second-class citizens, to be colored is also about inclusion, but it's also to go out and take it and make it your own, which is unbelievable what she's been doing at the moment. Obviously, we see her songs in the charts, and you've met her. You said she's got quite a personality about her. Mm-hmm. And that's what I would say really helps put a positive role model as a colored in the spotlight for this time. And she's young. She is young. She's like, she's going out there and she's killing it. And so many people can identify maybe with her, with her boldness, with her personality. She can dance. She looks great. She's musically, she can sing. It's like, she embodies a lot of, let's call it colored potential. Mm-hmm. She embodies a lot of, because we've got so much talent there that hasn't really been refined, or missed opportunities, or like devastating situations that just hold you back. And now she's there on the world stage saying, I am colored. It's like, wow. I'm surprised she doesn't have a flag.
And despite all these positive notions, and I can only assume that a lot of people are not aware of the colored history and mm-hmm. the ethnicity. Now, black people or the black community in America is pushing back, because to them, colored is considered a slur. Mm-hmm. So they have a hard time calling her that. Mm-hmm. And they say, now you're on American soil, so you should respect that and not call yourself that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so we have a discussion of, that's her, as you said, put it, her identity, mm-hmm. where she comes from, and is hurting an audience that she's appealing to musically. So how could you navigate that when that's literally you? It's not a term that you could let go of.
Yeah, it is a question of identity, and obviously not everyone can understand identities through the whole spectrum. I would say that is who she is. We cannot allow her to be anything else. That's the reason why people like her and love it. That's the reason why she's on that big stage. And she didn't have that grit and bit between the teeth to go out and get it, which is totally a hustler, hustler colored mentality, I don't think she would have been there. Also, we're not talking about oppression now. It's a term that came from oppression, but because we took such a long time to define our own identity, that's why one could identify as colored. I am colored. I identify as colored. It is very difficult for me to, it has been very difficult for me as well to accept the term that I'm black, because that comes with a totally different cultural heritage. It comes with a totally different understanding through which one sees the world. I see it through my colored perspective. And that's why I said, like, living in a colored area defines practically who you are. If you don't go through that experience of being colored and being perceived as the most dangerous person on the street, it's then very difficult to belong somewhere else than only your own self. Mm-hmm. And if I could use a colored way of explaining what other people think she should be calling herself because they feel a bit uncomfortable, they should go play on the street. They should go. They must just go. Like, seriously. Like, leave her to be herself, personally. And then leave it. The identity is something unique to South Africa. If that's the way she identifies and sees herself in South Africa, leave her.
I mean, that's a very good explanation of it. And that also shows how randomized race is. It's a construct. Because, for example, mm-hmm. here in Germany, mm-hmm. the term colored does not exist in day-to-day vocabulary. Mm-hmm. Most people would look at you and would say mixed race, or even in Germany, we'll call you black, which shows again, if I talk to you now, I say, oh, okay, mm-hmm. color, due to that, so I'm mm-hmm. going to call you that. Mm-hmm. I also don't have the negative history, but I also understand that's part of who you are. Okay. So why is me being hurt or offended more important than your actual identity?
Mm-hmm. I think we've had these conversations in the past where, how can I say? You cannot call it what it is if you haven't gone through the lived experience. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or along the lines of that. If you've lived as a colored, in a colored area, you know exactly what it means. If you can dance like a colored, you can sing like a colored, yeah. And if you can firstly or primarily make something of it as a colored, it's an unbelievable feat knowing what the colored experience actually is like in South Africa.
So I was born and raised in Johannesburg, South Africa. Well, when I was younger, I always wanted to be from America. I always was like, oh, I wish I was born in America. Just because I used to watch so many YouTube videos of people in America. But as I grew up, I realized like how amazing my childhood was in South Africa. Like the culture, the people, the music, the vibe. So yeah, growing up in South Africa was like the best childhood, and I wouldn't change it for anything. It's very different. Firstly, parties. In America, people don't really dance at parties. Like, they dance, but in South Africa, we dance, like, circles. Literally everybody in South Africa can dance. So we make circles, and we get on tables, we hang off ceilings, we climb things, and all our parties are literally, like, crazy.
Also, you delve into so many different ways of listening to the English accent, because you got in South Africa, you got the, how can I say, because many people don't speak only one language. Mm-hmm. Sometimes English could be a foreign language or their second language, and they have a more, let's say, Sotho English or Black English accent, which is a totally different one. And then we still listen to UK pop charts and UK pop culture, where you can understand the English as well as the Afrikaans kind of mixture of English, as well as this English, thoroughbred English, and then our own colored gepraatere English in that sense. So it's as if another parallel could be, look at Brazil. Mm-hmm. That is a wonderful color palette that is also displayed in the colored culture. There's everyone in there, from white passing to Ronaldo looking, to Ronaldinho looking, to everything. It's wonderful. It's very colorful. It's vibrant. It's a vibe. To be colored is a vibe. Mm-hmm. It's a vibe.
What do people in South Africa say? I think it's lekker.
Lekker. You know that lekker you can was used for everything. You can say that car looks lekker. This glass is lekker. The water is lekker. The weather is lekker. Like, yeah. It's lekker to be colored, for sure.
But the other thing that we need to do, so
this guy is laughing.
Edoboy, the Afrobeats prince Rema, he went to London and performed at
I ever told you the story? Sorry.
Hey.
Have I ever told you the story when of the first time I saw Rema live?
When and where?
Wow. That was back in the days. It was about, I think it was 2019.
Do maybe Rema now.
Mm-hmm. That's when I saw him. It was Bole Festival in Port Harcourt. I was there live and direct with a friend of mine. Ozzyk, a stylist, a great stylist based in Nigeria. I think he's now in Lagos. So, went to the festival and I experienced Dumebi Rema, and it was wild. It was wild. I was looking there. I was just standing there and watching him perform, and I was like, it's just a matter of time until he blows up internationally. Crazy.
One question that is very important for the context today. Was he already screaming on stage? Like, Rema shouts.
Can you please do a Rema shout?
Like, when you say hello before that, you know, also like Burna Boy and other artists, how they use a shout artistically. I'm too embarrassed to do it right now, but you understand. Was he already doing that? You know, this rave type of energy.
No, it was, I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think so. Mm-hmm. He was still the young, charming baby brother type of Rema.
Okay, so he progressed into it. But for the people...
Definitely, he also progressed in his, like, in his sense of fashion. Not to say he was unfashionable at that point, that's not what I'm saying, before people are coming from me on the internet, but you know, you will develop in your artistic way of thinking.
Yeah
That's what I'm saying,
because now for starters, Rema concert are called raves. What is a rave? You let loose on fast pace, in quotation marks, electronic music, here Afrobeat, that's why it's called Afro Rave. You go to a party to go crazy, to let loose. So I don't know what people were expecting when they were going to Rema concert. Worship and prayer, gospel or what? Like, I don't understand. But the thing that really, and I have to say, pissed me off, and I see that often in African communities, regarding our own culture, when we don't understand it, why do our minds strictly or immediately go to demonic? I need to rebuke that in the name of Jesus. What, bask me in the blood of Jesus, etc., because there is a ritual. And
oh, I can, should I? Well, you want me to dive into
You can dive into that. But just one last sentence is that we call it ritualistic, right? But culture is ritualistic. So when you have, in Germany called it Abendbrot, it's basically like the Last Supper, but with family every evening, because you want to come closer. So for Easter, you kind of like sacrifice a turkey. Like there's so much realistic behavior in our day-to-day life. But when it comes to African spirituality and religion and culture, suddenly we don't want to add context. Bask myself in the blood of Jesus. Like if you take the context away that he gave himself up for our sins, that is demonic if you think about it. Why should I wash myself in the blood of someone? So we need to add that context also to the continent of Africa and our various cultures. And you wrote a paper on that that I found very interesting. I would love for you to break that down.
Let me first start with the first question you asked, like, why are we considering that demonic all of a sudden, even though it's part of our culture? Mm-hmm. So I think it has a lot to do with ethnocentrism and sinocentrism. Ethnocentrism as, like, per definition, and I'm quoting, the evaluation or judgment of other cultures using the familiar culture of the observer as a standard of correct behavior.
Ooh, right? Okay. Carry on.
That's the definition of it. So, for example, the Christian church, and now if we're looking at Nigeria, we have 45% of Christians. Okay. We have 45% of Muslims. Mm-hmm. Kare, that is how many? 45 plus 45 is how much?
88. 45 plus
45.
I have 45 plus 45, 90%. Sorry.
Okay. The remaining, imagine, 90%. The remaining 10% are people who, you know, have traditional beliefs. Mm-hmm. 10%. 10%. Yes. 10%. Like, putting 10%. That's crazy. So the North is dominantly Muslim. The South is dominantly Christian. And then you have
very, like, similar in Cameroon. Same thing.
Mm-hmm. So the Christian church determines, in a way, the values of the Bible as absolute and correct. Mm-hmm. Something we are familiar with, right? Yes. And this happens regardless of the traditional history, norms, rituals, or whatever. So rather, traditional beliefs are seen as a part of the secular world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the worldly aspects, yes, that have to be eliminated.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what is happening in terms of ethnocentrism. And then at the same time, this ethnocentrism of the Christian community leads to sinocentrism, which is the opposite. So sinocentrism is the belief that products, styles, ideas of one society are inferior to those that originate elsewhere. So you'll be in Nigeria and you'll be thinking, I'm made in Nigeria, I beg Carigo. Let me go and get, made in Germany or whatever.
Uh-huh.
Right? Uh-huh. And it's also known that consumers in, I'll put this in, what's it called here? In
quotation
this
marks.
Quotation marks. What is this? Oh my God, what is happening with my camera?
The iPhone. You're being celebrated for speaking facts.
I swear. I'll put it in quotation marks because I'm quoting this, mm-hmm, right? Consumers in underdeveloped and developing societies frequently turn away from their own locally produced goods and instead purchase items imported. Mm-hmm. And we can translate items to anything. Items can be your phone, but items can also be traditions, mm-hmm, can also be customs and norms. Right, so traditional recipes to cure diseases, for example, are labeled as witchcraft,
yes, juju,
by Christian communities, exactly, along in various African countries. However, if I tell you these recipes are the same recipes that are being successfully sold in Europe and being promoted by Europeans to whom African communities within Africa still do not appear as equal. Mm-hmm.
This is also what I often want to say to, like, my brothers, my sisters, my siblings from continental Africa. Do you know that in Europe, they take, for example, Edo culture, a Benin bronze, and put it up in their living room because it's so artsy, because it's so culture relevant. So you are at the source demonizing their culture, but some middle income German family goes out of their way to buy your culture to show how sophisticated they are in culture in Germany. Do we understand what we are doing here? And I also understand there's colonialism playing into that, where they had this logic of terra nullius. That basically means even if they're people, there's no civilization, there's no intelligence. So we have to reform them. We have to, because they're subhuman. This is how they saw us, perceive us, and till today. And from that logic on, they brought a bastardized version of also the Bible as the only way that is superior to everything that is uncivilized in Africa. And they did this around the world, Latin America, even in China, etc. And they installed that in us so that we detach ourselves from our essence, from our core. But funnily, even when we are like Christian, as you say, in Nigeria, Cameroon, South Africa, Botswana, whatsoever, we still practice traditional beliefs because this, you know, customs at marriage or the way your mother holds you, your father does certain things for you. Do you think that that is coming out of nowhere? Culture is a way, it's a tool to facilitate life, but also to celebrate where you're from and to build community. So culture is not, it's also not random. It's also a way to live better together. Like, and also, we're also very spiritual people, so we live in exchange with nature. But that was kind of taken from us, because imagine if you appreciate, love yourself, and you are in tune with your culture and where you are from. How can you be colonized? You will reject everything that tells you to hate yourself and hate where you are from. And this is what I'm seeing in London. So that's why you could say Rema's performance was anti-colonial. Because where was he performing? In London. Where are the bronzes of the most known Oba king in Edo? What's the term? Exhibited in London? The London Museum, Linde Museum in Stuttgart, where I am, and Metropolitan in New York. Like, he put that on stage and they burnt down the palace because they wanted to loot it. So they display it in London and brag about how cultured they are. But we back home, we are ashamed of that. The math is not mathing.
And it's very interesting because I feel like we are clinging to religion so hard and in a way sometimes so desperately that we are not able to, as you said, detach ourselves from it and see beyond the, you know, just look at the bigger picture. And I mean, you can do that without being un-Christian in a way. Mm-hmm. You can detach yourself and just look at the, you know, just look at facts in a way. And so when I wrote this paper, I first tried to decipher for myself, what is actually the meaning of religion? Where are we coming from when we're talking about religion? And I found it very interesting. There's a French sociologist. You probably know him as well, Emile Durkheim.
Mm-hmm. I heard of him and I read some texts about him, from him in uni.
And I will quote something he says. There are no religions which are false. All are true in their own fashion. all answer, though, in different ways to the given conditions of human existence.
The given conditions of human existence. There are different given conditions in Africa, in that Europe, in different Asia. It's like a diet.
That's it.
You won't find an apple in Nigeria naturally, but you will find yam, cassava. So you will eat cassava because that's best for you there. I beg. I did tire.
Right. And then we'll even... Let me continue. Mm-hmm. Make us stress you small. He also sees religion, for example, as... Now, I will be butchering French here. Un fait social. Mm-hmm. Jesus. A social fact. Yeah.
The accent was not... The accent was pretty good. Un fait social.
I tried.
You do well.
I needed my whole body to do that. So therefore... Okay, no, let's decipher what that means in his words. And I will quote again. Mm-hmm. A social fact is identifiable through the power of external coercion which it exerts or is capable of exerting upon individuals. Mm-hmm. So therefore, we can see religious beliefs in a way as an instrument to emphasize what is important to society in terms of values, norms, or sanctions.
Yes.
Right? So our traditional beliefs would tell us what is important to us mm-hmm. at the given conditions of our human existence that we're in.
It's also to protect yourself. Time. Like to, when we have like... We have Juju Kalaba, don't whistle at night because you will attract animals. That is culture. That is not random. That is passed down.
Their sense.
Because there was someone back then who was whistling and died and was attacked. You understand? He was caught. So when I see a young boy, I believe is 23 years old, being in London of all places, who looted his kingdom, the Edo kingdom, that existed from 1201 to 1897, that has still these bronzes and artifacts from there and refused to give them back.
And we are fighting.
And we are still fighting.
Today, as we speak.
To get them back and displace his rich culture on stage from the red, the color Ododo was established by the King Iruare. And so many more aspects, even the horse, because Edo warriors and royalty rode on horses. So the whole concept was, you could say it's an anti-colonial project if you want to make it that deep, because it really was. It was surrounded. The theme was war. We are fighting against an external definition of what we are worth. And the problem, how people use religion, is in that sense of superiority. And also see tribalism in there. Because also in Cameroon, as in Nigeria, some ethnic groups, due to their perceived proximity to religion, they think they're better than others. Because there was one TikToker who said, yeah, he was chanting. If it was Yoruba, I would have understood. I would have felt more comfortable. But because he was singing in Edo Bini language, now it's demonic. You understand what I'm trying to say? So I'm like, can we be honest and also say when we don't understand another African here, Edo culture, and can we sit down, educate ourselves, and then come back and not hop on chants and just scream, oh, it's demonic, did it because there's a bet. Go to King Square at 5 p.m. in Benin City, Abiyama. You see bets covering the sky.
It's not... bats are still okay, but look at here. We should be calling the New York rats demonic. As from what I've heard,
bet bugs in France right now. Is this not demonic?
Demonic.
That sounds like Egypt when Moses and God, when they were bringing the plague. So you see, when we add context, suddenly, why they're being punished because they've been not faithful to God. Like, you see how you can frame it and suddenly they deserve what they got. So this is what I'm saying. I just want people to appreciate African cultures as Africans, ask questions first instead of judging, and informing oneself and also admitting to ignorance, because it's harmful to do that, because you reproduce things based on a false sense of superiority, thinking that Christianity is the only way of life for you. The next person is a Muslim. That's the right way of life for them. And then spiritual, Yoruba's religion. Like, please, please, people.
As we said, like, I love Durkheim for the sentence he gave us. Like, for real. Mm-hmm. In different ways to the given conditions of human existence. Mm-hmm. He's my G for that sentence, for that definition. Love it.
And with that, we are not saying that there's not juju and there are not wicked people who misuse juju. There are people who put curses on you. That is also true.
But you always, you have it everywhere. Mm-hmm. You have it everywhere. You do not only have that in traditional religions or traditional beliefs. You also have it in the Catholic Church.
Thank you. Like,
come for me.
Thank you. Thank you.
You get, so it's always a matter of perspective. Mm-hmm. It's a matter of viewing the matter at hand holistically.
And also how it's applicated, because you can always appropriate on and abuse a belief of religion. Like, we call, you know, the gospel that you will become rich after death, right? This was being told to poor people, especially in the global majority, the global south, like in Cameroon, in Nigeria, wherever around the world. You're suffering now so you can be rich later. So that is in a very manipulative way. And people, you also use as hierarchies. As in, like, if you think about that, because if we put logic into all of that and also somehow science, why is Jesus white in an African church? I'm not saying that he's from Cameroon, but he's white with blue eyes and blonde hairs. Do you understand? Do you even know what he was speaking? Hebrew? Like, in the region, you speak Hebrew, Aramaic, those type of languages back then. He was not a white man. He did not have blonde hair, neither blue eyes. So what you're being taught was also so that you hate yourself and aspire to be like that, Anglo-Saxon.
Which you will never be.
Exactly. Because that,
due to given circumstances.
So in essence, you being African with that picture of what Christianity is, defined by Europe, you could never be holy if you really deep it.
You know what I wondered? Mm-hmm. I was wondering whether the idea of demonizing African traditional beliefs came by the fear of consequence that follows by these traditional beliefs. For example, Christianity can be seen as a tool that exists for the purpose of salvation.
Yes.
No matter what you do, I can come to you, I can kill you today, I might still end up in heaven. Because Jesus died, washed my sins away, and if I turn to God, I will be free of the fact that I actually killed you.
Just have to repent,
in a way. Yes. Right? Mm. So. And then on the other hand, you have traditions, beliefs that will sanction you without any possibility of salvation, redemption, repentance, or anything. If I kill you, I will be killed for the fact that I killed you. And I was wondering if this ultimate, what can we call it, sanction that comes with it, if it's something that was feared by colonial powers back in the day, that made them feel like, okay, we have to eliminate this in order to, I don't know what.
I would say to a certain point, I would agree, but also think that people that have so much power, so they can ignore religion or the church, they're not thinking about church when they are going for gold, for diamonds, etc. I think it was also a fear of, look at the Haitian Revolution, like the first liberated black country. How did they organize to voodoo and hoodoo? And if you break that down, it's not necessarily juju. It's calling forth the ancestors and seances and asking for guidance and strength. And again, it can also be abused for curses. There's always several sides to
Two sides to it,
exactly. Yeah. So you see this. I, as a white colonizer who wants to keep these black people subhuman, and I have to explain it somehow to all these Europeans who are also, let's, the majorities are peasants, right? So in the Bible, it say, love your neighbor, etc. Now we're going somewhere. They are humans. They look like us. They're just darker. I don't have any prejudice whatsoever. So now I have to create a system that justifies everything that I'm doing. So I'm, for once, scared for that they revolt and kill me because I see how spiritually strong they are. Secondly, I might go to hell. But if they're not human, if they're animals, they can technically be sacrificed. So there are many factors. So you have to create a system that justifies
No. Yeah, I get. And you also have the fact of the idea of... what is it called in English? If you only believe in one God...
Monotheism.
Thank you. You know, and that's... them believing in multiple gods, or us believing in multiple gods, having, I don't know, God for successful harvest or blah, 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 blah. You know, that itself is, I don't want to say that word, demonic.
Insane. I mean, you're heathen, right? And then they tell you look, you are poor. If you believe in that version that was brought during colonization and slavery, you are suffering right now. You're on these fields, like you're doing these crops, sugar, etc. You being in these mines in Congo. But if you believe in God, as soon as all of this is over, you will have 40 women, milk, honey, whatever you want. Doesn't that sound sweet to you?
It sounds high-key, low-key sexist.
I know, but you understand what I'm saying. Of course, to a woman, you will say something slightly different. Of course it is, but...
You'll be one of 40 women!
But let's also, patriarchy is also deeply intertwined. But think about that. So, if I tell you also as a king, you already believe in Orishas, etc., if you give yourself to Jesus Christ, you will be even stronger, my king. Now you can have an even bigger kingdom. We will give you some weapons. I take out some guns. I demonstrate it. You're like, So I just have to pretend or believe or baptize myself, and now I have this.
That sounds very easy. I think much of it was actually... you know, implemented in a very brutal,
that also. Way. But these were actual examples. Queen Nyanga and many other people, even the Bamum King in Cameroon. But the rest was brutal. Like they really killed people in their essence. But we're giving you history lessons.
But at the end of the day, like I'm gonna quote another person here. The most barbarous and the most fantastic rites and the strangest myths translate some human needs, some aspect of life, either individual or social. So it doesn't matter, even, you know, if we're looking at European history, there have been crazy people out here. Like, it doesn't matter where we turn to in history, we'll always find like super barbarous myths or ways of life or customs, etc. And it's very interesting because to understand the real meaning behind whatever we meet, we have to decode these practices.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yes.
I mean, Abraham going to the mountain and sacrificing or being willing to sacrifice his son, his only son, in form of a ritual. What is the need behind that? Why is he willing to do that? What is, I don't know, what do they yearn for in that period of time? Mm-hmm. What does his community need in that period of time? Mm-hmm. So I feel like we as diasporans are not educated enough on different myths from the motherland.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're very quick to wanting to tell others or wanting to tell our brothers and sisters from the motherland how to identify themselves, how to pray correctly, that whatever they're doing is demonic or whatever.
Very patronizing.
But do we actually put in the work to understand mm-hmm. where they're coming from? Where we are coming from? Like, that's hardly happening. And I don't know, I understand that for some in the diaspora, it's difficult to do so because you might, you know, have grown up with a white parent who's not familiar with that, or you do not have contact with your African family or whatever. But there are lots, dozen, innumerous amounts of books that work on deciphering that and that mm-hmm. work, you know, in ways of bringing that to the table.
Mm-hmm. So you have to put in the effort and stop being intellectual lazy and
yeah,
just grasp for yeah. the easier route, because we often do that.
Yeah.
And
because you don't know what demonic is if you haven't read German Märchen.
Is it fairy tales, right?
Fairy tales, yeah. European
fables, yeah.
They're crazy.
And someone said under the post, how do you know how a demon looks like? How do you know? How many demons have you seen so that you know how to define
in your life that you
uh-huh. So where have you seen these images as a Christian to know that what you have seen at Rama's court was a demon?
I beg, enlighten us. I need to understand.
That's what I said. Also, like, there was a video that animated the creatures that were shown in the Bible.
Mm.
And if I use now the same logic and give no context, they look so scary. They had 100 eyes and wings, etc. Like,
even the description, let alone the description mm-hmm. in the Bible, this, what do they call it? Offenbarung, the last
Revelation.
The last book in the Bible, Revelation.
Like, if you look at this without context, right? And you come from a slightly different angle, that's demonic. How do you have so many wings and eyes all covered over your... And if I look at you, I'm being burned away. And by that, I'm not saying that Christianity is bad. I'm just saying, you see how...
It's a matter of perspective. Exactly. You have to... You need context to really understand and to decipher. That's... At the end, that's the essence.
Yes, exactly. So you do with it whatever you want. But let's also appreciate Africans who proudly show their African where they are from. And if you see a concert like that, after listening to this episode, sit down and educate yourself about the culture, ask questions. And if you still say that it is demonic and from your perspective, point taken. We won't argue. You did your research. You could be wrong. You could be right. I don't know. But at least you did the work.
Okay, I don't... That's it. That's it.
Anyways, my people, it was a long episode. Mob will be coming out in English because this is a bilingual. Is it bilingual? Trilingual? There's sometimes pidgin.
Multilingual. I don't know about. I know about myself, but this Mr. Man here over there, He speaks multiple languages. If you're not careful, whatever tribe you're coming from, he will learn your language.
But, you know, for the Edo people, if we butchered names or terms, etc., all I can say, Iga Zedo Kakaba. In that sense, peace and love, my people. Until the next episode, follow, support, share, and love Africa to the world.